I'm Mark Purcell, and this is Cincinnati Edition for a Saturday morning where it's time to go On the Money with Chris DeSimeo.
Another volatile week on Wall Street finished last week. Markets bobbing up and down after being closed on Monday for Labor Day until Thursday morning. Then Thursday morning, the European Central Bank unveiled yet another set of tools to stabilize the credit situation in that country. And also on Thursday, the ADP, the Automated Data Processing Survey of Jobs, actually showed job growth more than double expectations, north of 200,000, and the markets actually finished up more than 200 points on Thursday. However, yesterday morning, the much-anticipated August jobs report came in, and a mixed bag at best. The unemployment rate itself overall fell two notches to 8.1% from 8.3%. However, many analysts had actually raised their estimates of non-farm payroll growth. The consensus was around 123. It came in at a paltry 96,000. And so not exactly a confirmation yesterday from the Bureau of Labor Statistics of the ADP report on Thursday. Anyway, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show our friend John Dorfman. John, a syndicated columnist in the Pittsburgh Tribune, also many years in Bloomberg, frequently seen on CNBC, and a money manager himself of quite a good deal of well-earned renown. And John, thanks again so much for joining us all the way from Boston. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah. John, what are some of your thoughts on yesterday's employment figures? Why was there such a disconnect between the ADP numbers and what the Bureau of Labor Statistics said? How can that be?
It can be because trends are only clear in retrospect. You know, whenever you're looking at contemporary data, you always have the stoplight flashing red, green, and yellow at the same time. And I think that the employment picture is getting better, but with agonizing slowness. You know, we've come down from a peak of 10% unemployment to around 8.1 now, and the average length of the work week has been lengthening, which is often a precursor to hiring. Surveys of employers also show that they still intend to hire in the remainder of 2012 and 2013. I think things are getting better, just much more slowly than anyone would like to see.
Yeah. Well, some things that kind of move in slow motion. It's fun to go back and look at some predictions that took place earlier in the year. Here we are now nearly three quarters of the way through the investment year. And back in January, some of your columns, which you which are archived online, there'll be a link to where your columns are from the WVXU.org website. But earlier in the year, you described how to identify companies, stocks that are just somewhere between hated and despised. You call them your outliers. What is the outlier portfolio, and how do you apply the various filters to come up with this list?
This has been a fun experiment that I've been doing for about a dozen years. I'm a devotee of low PE, that is low price earnings investing, as practiced over the years by such people as David Dreeman, who was my mentor, Jonathan Leff, Sir John Templeton, and what we're trying to find is stocks that are unpopular where we believe the company's prospects are better than people think. But what the outliers portfolio, which I used to call the robot portfolio, does is it simply picks the 10 lowest PE stocks in the market that are above a certain size and whose debt is not too swollen. And if you use that mechanistic approach, over the last dozen years, you would have had heart-stopping ups and downs, but your overall return would have been many-fold times the return of the market or most money managers. So these are stocks that most people wouldn't dare touch. They often sell at PEs of 4 or 5, 6, and 7, or sometimes 8. And they're all always unpopular for a reason. But when all the problems are out there on the surface, sometimes the good news is hidden, and only the bad news is what investors are focusing on.
Sure.
And investors that tend to get overcommitted with optimism or pessimism. So in this case, these are stocks that may have potential to surprise favorably.
And they are drawn to popularity like moths to a porch light. These PE, of course, a price-to-earnings ratio, simply is how many dollars do you pay in price to get a dollar of earnings. And throughout history, that number is around 15 or so.
Yep.
And so if you can have if you can build a position in a company whose shares are trading at a third of that price, then theoretically you have a cushion. You mentioned it's worked out. I think in your column you said that over the last 13 years, this has done over 23% versus 3.7% for the market. How's it doing so far in 2012?
That is a very good question, but I haven't checked.
Yeah.
I will, however, update the results in my first column in 2013. So
okay.
The first week of 2013, I'll definitely have the answer for you in the column.
Sure. So how many companies typically make the cut when you put together a list like this? This isn't supposed to take the place of an overall portfolio or a balanced portfolio. This is something that people can do with some of their money that they just don't have time to go to Vegas with. Is that...
Well, you can use it that way, yes, or you can use it the way I do, which is as a source of ideas to look at, and you can attempt to cherry pick. I remember one year back in the 2000s, I attempted to cherry pick, and the ones I picked didn't do particularly well. And the stock that I could least stand the idea of buying, more than doubled that year. But other years, I have, done well with the ones I picked out, but. It's a good way to force yourself to look at some names that you normally wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. And that's the tough part, because investors tend to let their emotions stand between them and making money, and sometimes having one of these, a formula and sticking with it, regardless of what it turns up, regardless of how foul-smelling some of it might be, can help really lead you in a very profitable direction.
This is an extreme of a value investing approach that is tried and true, and that is simply to buy the less popular half or fourth or decile of the market. These stocks in my outliers portfolio are the bottom 1% of the market, really by PE, and I arbitrarily cut it off for the column purposes as the bottom 10 stocks. So it's even a little. Less than 1%, but there's an abundance of academic and practitioner literature that shows that low PE stocks over the years have outperformed high PE stocks by several percentage points.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, also during the early parts of the year is when various research departments produce these wonderful lists that everyone then uses as a starting point to figure out how to allocate money for the coming year. What happens, John, and you address this in one of your columns, what happens when too many analysts like a company or fall in love with a stock?
This is another experiment that I've been doing for a lot of years now, and the results have kind of amazed me. Each year, I look at the four stocks that analysts love the best, that is to say, those that have nothing but buy recommendations from the largest number of brokerage houses. So typically, you can get 10, 12, or more brokerage houses that all like a stock and no dissenting votes, no holds, no sells. And those stocks, which I call the adored stocks, have performed worse than the S&P. I also look at the most hated stocks, those where there's a fair number of sell recommendations. I don't usually find a unanimous number of sell recommendations, but maybe four analysts with two or three, or occasionally four sells. So these are the most hated stocks on Wall Street. Those stocks have also underperformed the S&P, but the hated stocks on average have done better than the adored stocks. Analysts do a lot of great work, and they are a wonderful source of information, but their buy and sell opinions are not sacrosanct, so people should not hesitate to make their own final decisions.
I guess the answer, the conclusion that you can draw from that is that if you're investing in something that everyone admits to liking, it's already priced like that, so there's not much room for error.
Yeah, especially if it's followed by 10 or more analysts. Go back a bunch of years, say everyone loved Microsoft, most likely its glory years were already behind it. And when analysts heard, when they're unanimous, seems to be when they're most likely to be wrong.
John, you manage, a lot of money in Boston. This has been an interesting year, the so-called sell in May and go away. at the end of May, looked like it was going to assert itself again, and that just hasn't played out so far this summer. It's been a fairly interesting rally from June through here in early September. What pockets of the market in the last 50 seconds that we have not fully participated in this? And if someone had, you know, fresh dollars to allocate to equities, what sectors would seem to offer the most opportunity now that we've had this big jump up?
I think that the industrial sector contains a lot of stocks that are not yet overpriced and are likely to benefit from a cyclical recovery. I'm also beginning, after at least 4 years away from the sector, to look at home builders again, because there's 2.3 million people living in basements, and a lot of people have stayed in their homes longer than they would want. I think there's some pent-up demand. And I think the auto sector also has pent-up demand, with the average car on the road being about 11 years old. So those are three places that I would particularly look at.
Industrials, autos, and home builders. And John Dorfman from Boston, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
It's my pleasure.
And for Cincinnati Edition, I'm Chris DeSimio on The Money.